From WMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour. I'm Patrick Madden, sitting in for Kodjo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer with City Paper. Tom, as always, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here. Good afternoon, everybody.
Tom, how are you doing today?
Great. I'm over Thanksgiving, I think. I've got a little bit more of the leftovers in, some kind of pie with liquor in it. I still haven't finished.
Still holding strong. So, Tom, let's start today in Maryland. Earlier this week, Governor Larry Hogan announced he wanted to create an emergency commission to redraw the controversial boundaries of Western Maryland's congressional district. This is the 6th district. And this, of course, is all about gerrymandering. What do you think's going on with this kind of emergency announcement?
Well, the governor wants an independent commission in this to do the redistricting after the next census. And the legislature has not gone along. It has said, a Democratic legislature has said, it will do it if other states do it. And the governor thinks that that's a cop-out. He thinks the Republican governor wants a redistricting done. So the legislature has, based on a court law, a court case, until next March to redraw the districts, principally for the 6th congressional district, which is an abomination in everyone's opinion. So the governor decided he would appoint this emergency commission, the 9 members, and it will draw a redistricting plan. The problem is whatever the commission comes up with for the governor has to be submitted to the legislature. And the legislature may throw it out, or they may pass something different, and the governor can veto that. This is part of the big national redistricting across the country that's occurring. Maryland's just having a real bad fight about the 6th district.
Right.
In Virginia, there's 11 House districts, not Congress, but state House districts.
And, of course, the other part of this equation is the Supreme Court. And when Attorney General Brian Frosch, who's a Democrat, you know, appealed this to the Supreme Court, there's this question whether or not the Supreme Court takes this up, and what does Maryland actually want to happen in this? Do they want to set the precedent of sort of the parameters around this redistricting conversation or not?
Well, the governor wants people the state just to go with the commission. Brian Frosch is not who wants it, has this lawsuit, and he wants the Supreme Court, like other attorneys general, to decide, for the Supreme Court to decide what are the requirements for redistricting.
And speaking of politics in Maryland, big vote coming up. This is to lead the Maryland Democratic Party. Rocky Moore Cummins has announced that she's challenging Kathleen Matthews. What's at stake here, Tom?
Well, this is the party leadership in the state. There are about 400 or so Democrats will be meeting in Lanham, Maryland tomorrow at the IBEW, if I say those letters correctly, headquarters there. They're electing the party chairman. Kathleen Matthews has been the chair for the last 2 years. You can say the state party had a great election this year. They didn't defeat Governor Hogan, but they won county executive spots, delegate spots. They held back the Republican effort to get more seats in the Senate. So Kathleen Matthews thinks the party's been unified and working hard, and she's running. Ms. Rocky Moore Cummins, you know, she ran for governor briefly last year. Earlier this year, because it seems like last year. And she dropped out because her husband was ill. Now she wants to just jump into the party. It's going to be an interesting election. These are all the vice chairs, who gets to go to the conventions. But it's going to be quite the thing. It all should be over by 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
Definitely something to watch. And in Virginia, this is definitely interesting. The enrollment in the expanded Medicaid program, which was obviously this huge fight for years in Virginia. Well, the enrollment figures show that a lot more people have signed up, which is, I guess, from depending on your vantage point, good or bad. So,
well, good if people need health care.
Exactly. But I guess the other question is, you know, can the state afford it? But Medicaid's paid for by the federal government.
Yes, 90% of it's paid by the federal government. But this is the long 5-year fight. Our guests could probably bring us up to date on some of it. But the fact is, people need health care. 90% of the Medicare funds will be paid, Medicaid funds, will be paid by the federal government. And it's a good thing that people are signing up for health care.
And speaking of our guest Today we are joined by Mark Keem. He is a member of the Virginia House of Delegates. He is a Democrat. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you, Patrick.
And first, just tell us, first of all, the 35th District, where is that?
So my district starts at Tyson's Corner and ends at the Fair Oaks Mall with the town of Vienna in the middle, Oakton, and Dunloring, among other.
So it must
areas.
Be really fun when you have to drive during rush hour in between.
Yeah, traffic is certainly one of the biggest topics that all of us talk about and think about.
So let's just jump into sort of the big news that's happening right now in mm-hmm. Virginia, and you're playing a role in this. And this is Virginia Governor Ralph Northam. He's facing blowback after replacing two members of the State Air Pollution Control Board with people seen to be more sympathetic to Dominion Energy. Dominion, of course, is the big political behemoth and the utility in Virginia. And this is all regarding this key vote about this natural gas facility in the historically black community of Union Hill. So obviously there's a lot going on here. So Mark, first of all, can you just sort of give us a sense of what this is all about?
Sure, absolutely. And thank you for the opportunity. There are two pipelines that have been proposed to go through Virginia. So it starts in West Virginia, ends in North Carolina, and it'll go through Virginia several hundred miles worth. And the two pipelines, one is designed, it's called the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, the other one's a Mountain Valley Pipeline. But they're both very, very duplicative in that they almost track the same area. And so the first question that you have to ask is, what is this for and why, and is it necessary? And based on my research and the research that many experts have done, it is absolutely not a necessary matter. It's not economically or environmentally needed. And yet it's been approved by the federal level. So the question now is, what can we at the state level, the governor, all of us as legislators, and the Department of Environmental Quality, what can we do to try to either stop and or ensure that everything is done by the books? And this is where the controversy came in about 2 weeks ago. I've been opposed to this along with a lot of other people because based on the economic needs, there's just not a need for these pipelines. We already have plenty of pipelines in Virginia that carry methane gas. But the problem here was this governor, who's a friend of mine, he's a Democrat, fellow party person, has, during the campaign, said he's going to make sure that he does everything right to protect the environmental concerns and the neighborhoods and the property damage and such. And he's told me on many occasions as his administration that they are not intervening. This is a federal matter, that the state has very little role, even though we disagree.
He said that throughout the campaign.
Yes. And I've written letters to him, and they've verified. What he did 2 weeks ago was he actually proactively now, affirmatively, has intervened on one side and not on the other side.
So talk about that. What happened?
Specifically, there are three or four agencies that are involved with this process, including citizen board members. So citizens like myself and others would serve as volunteers to give advice to the governor through his agencies. And these citizens' role is to make a judgment just based on objective facts. At the process where the Air Control Board, Air Pollution Control Board, was looking at a particular part of this pipeline, it's called a compressor station in Union Hill in Buckingham County.
This is the historic African-American community, which is... Well, there's been some concern about its effect on that community.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
So the mayor... So let's cut to the chase. Yeah. The governor took off two people who had been serving and had been critical of this pipeline, put on two people who we don't know what their position is, at least I don't, maybe you do, and there's a key vote coming up on December the 10th for this compressor and the pipeline to go forward.
That's right.
Have you heard anything from the governor politically about, as I understand it, these two new people won't be allowed to vote because they're too new. So is this going to be by the remaining members that are going to vote and approve this compressor?
So it's
What's the politics of it?
Well, for me, it's very disappointing because this is not the way it's supposed to be done. Whether you're for or against the pipelines, the idea that a governor can intervene and take two people off of a citizen advisory board, I mean, granted, their terms are expired, but the other 235 members who serve in similar capacities around the state, their terms have expired as well since the same day. They're still serving. And so the governor and his people choosing two particular people right before a decision is about to be made and telling them that the term's over, so please leave, and then replacing them with two people we have no background on is really an unusual matter.
Is it a nine-member board? Is
that seven members.
Seven members. So these two people who were taken off who were opposing it, and the two new can't vote, so that means the five people on the board now will make this decision.
And my understanding is that one of the five has recused him or herself, which means that you're down to four members, and it really makes a mockery
and
of
so
the process.
I mean, sort of the elephant in the room here is Dominion power, right? I mean, this is a very politically powerful they're a utility, but they're a powerful company.
Largest donor in political campaigns in Virginia.
Exactly.
In all campaigns. Because yep. Some environmental groups gave more money to
If you're talking about one individual organization or individual donor, yes.
And so the perception has been that perhaps Northam is acting because this is what Dominion wants, this permit. They need it for this pipeline. And that's why the governor replaced these two people who have sort of questioned this process,
have in
right?
Fact
well,
questioned.
And Patrick, if you look at just the facts and nothing else, that's the only conclusion you can make. There is absolutely no other conclusion to make, because if you say, this is a routine matter, the governor has a right to appoint or reappoint whoever he wants, why would you single out two members on a controversial matter right before the vote's about to happen?
Well, you answer that. You say you were very close. You campaigned for Ralph Northam.
Yes.
You've supported him. You've worked with him and all of that. But since November 16th, when this replacement deal was done, yes. The governor said, all right, you guys are out. My new people are in. Have you spoken directly to the governor or someone who can speak on his behalf and say, what was the point? Because the governor's office says, look, their terms are up. We have other people who can serve. We're replacing them. It has nothing to do with the momentousness of this pipeline decision. Have you spoken to the governor?
I have not spoken to the governor personally, and I've reached out to his senior staff, and many, many other people, both on the environmental side as well as others have. And the answer we're getting is the exact same answer that you're hearing in the public, which is that this is just a routine matter, but there's nothing routine about it.
Is this vote going to be on December the 10th?
I believe so.
Yeah, I looked on the environmental quality webpage. There's no, I could not find it on the list of events.
It's in Richmond.
Joining us in studio is Mark Keem, a House of Delegate from Virginia. I mean, Mark, yes. you've worked at the State House. I mean, how powerful is Dominion? I mean, this issue seems to come up every election. You have candidates, I guess, like yourself, who now say you will not accept donations
right.
from Dominion.
That's right.
I mean, can you talk about that dynamic?
Well, I think part of it is Dominion is an example, one symptom, but the problem is the fact that we've had business as usual in Virginia for a long, long time. I think part of it is that we haven't had many really huge national attention-grabbing issues that come up, and we certainly don't have C-SPAN covering us live, gavel to gavel, which means that a lot of things happen behind closed doors. A lot of things happen in Virginia and in Richmond where it's just a matter of private conversation. So in that world of less transparency, it's easy to see how one or two or three companies or individuals that have influence can really dominate the conversation. I think that's what's happened in Virginia for generations. Dominion in particular happens to be the largest size in terms of the employment and the dollar amount of their donations, but also because they have so many issues that come up before the General Assembly that I think they just are overwhelmingly present everywhere we go in Virginia.
Going back just briefly to the pipeline, because sure. We talked the whole time, we got lots of issues, is the state NAACP, which had previously expressed great concern about this compressor in this community in far western Virginia there, African-American community being adversely affected by the pipeline and the compressor, just in the last 48 hours or so, has said that it has a lot of its questions have been answered. What's happening there? What's the politics behind the NAACP state organization softening its opposition?
Sure, Tom, and thank you for asking that, because I really want to clarify this. This morning there was a news story that was very inaccurate from my perspective. The NAACP has been on the record throughout this process standing for environmental justice, standing for the fact that this compressor station that they're proposing in Union Hill in Buckingham County is not what they want, not something that would allow for anybody in that community to have the healthy air they need. And so they've been very clear about this. I think what's happened is that maybe a week or so ago, Dominion lobbyists were circulating a letter that they found from one person who represents a board member on the NAACP, not saying that they are for or against the pipelines, but their point was, if and when the pipeline is to be built, if it does get built, then they want to make sure that their safety is included in that. And I think what Dominion is trying to do is using that language saying, hey, there's a division.
Well let's be clear about that, just for the politics of it. Mm-hmm. It's according to the news reports,
sure.
is from the state conference president, Kevin Chandler, who said that they told Ralph Northam, his organization, not just one person in that organization, is satisfied with the progress and efforts Dominion Energy has made to work with the key, blah, blah, blah. So that's a big change. That's the president of the NAACP. But that's not a member.
Yeah, but Tom, if you look at the language very carefully, it does not contradict what NAACP already has said, which is they are opposed to having this place here. Their question here, the conversation now is about one member of NAACP saying that they appreciate the fact that Dominion has come in. They've offered lots of money to them. They want to buy them libraries. They want to have STEM programs. These are great programs that they're offering. We accept that idea of you wanting to come and negotiate. But in terms of environmental justice and the racial aspect of it, they're very strong.
And just to be clear, NAACP said they would prefer it not be built, but if it's going to go forward, we think it's been satisfied. We're going to get all these benefits.
At least one person has said that, yes.
He's the president of head of the NAACP. He's not just one person.
Yeah. No, I'm not speaking for or against NAACP, but I've heard from other members of the NAAACP board who are saying there's
But it's the head of it, so go ahead.
Let's switch gears and talk about the big news with Amazon coming to Northern Virginia. Now, this is going to affect your neighbor to the east, Arlington County, although you used to live in Crystal City.
At one point, I did, yes.
What is this going to do to traffic, to affordable housing? I mean, is there anything right now that the State House, anyone can do to sort of help ease these concerns over the impact of this?
Sure. First of all, it's a good news, bad news story. The good news is Virginia will benefit in the long run by having more jobs come and allowing us to diversify our economy and making sure that more technology companies can really think of Virginia as a place for innovation. Bad news is it's coming to the worst place in Virginia, Northern Virginia, where there's already enough traffic, already enough high unaffordable housing as well as traffic congestion. So my hope was, had Amazon decided to come, that they would not place it in Northern Virginia, but rather somewhere else in Virginia. That would have been the ideal place. Now, as far as the transportation and the housing, what I've heard from the county, both Arlington as well as Alexandria, the most impacted places, is that they will be investing in transportation. They'll be investing in making sure that the housing costs are not going to be exorbitant. I've seen some studies that say that the housing won't go any more than any other employments and new jobs coming in. In my area, I represent Tysons and Vienna. I'm sure I'll have some employees who will want to live out where I am. All that would do is add to the traffic that we already have. And as you know, we have a very controversial tolling on I-66 both inside and outside the Beltway. At the exact same time that we're trying to fight and curb more traffic congestion and trying to find other mass transit ways, this would add to that.
You're actually trying to rebrand Tysons. It's now called Tysons, not Tysons Corner. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That's not official or anything, is it?
Well, it's
but
Tysons,
the point being is you guys are trying to make that a more human scale place rather than just big buildings, shopping mall. Do you think Amazon coming over as it adds jobs over the next 5 to 10 years will be a net plus or a net minus?
From an economic perspective, I think it'll be a net plus.
What about a lifestyle?
A lifestyle and congestion problem, I think it'll be a net negative.
I mean, but in the State House, I mean, I gather that's part of this deal. I mean, the Virginia has to allocate a certain number of funds for transportation infrastructure improvements, right? So there is...
So my understanding is that the General Assembly will be voting on three different aspects of this. One would be the cash subsidy for the jobs. But just to be clear, unlike the other program, I think New York and other places that they're talking
about,
our cash, not only the amount would be smaller, but it would come only after the jobs have been in place for 3 or 4 years. So there wouldn't be any net cost coming up front. There's no cash going up before the jobs are here, and if the jobs never materialize, we wouldn't be spending a single penny.
It's graduated.
And then on the transportation part of it, my understanding is that the area formerly known as Crystal City, which is now National Landing, I think they should have a symbol like Prince. Right? Area formerly known as Crystal City is going to end up coming up with some funding both on Alexandria and Arlington County side to make sure that their transportation corridors are fixed. And then the last piece is the education, where Virginia Tech and other consortium will add more cyber and technology-related schools in that area.
Oh, no, totally different subject.
Sure.
The ERA.
Yes.
People have to go back in history to remember what that is, 70s. But Virginia, after many decades, your colleague, Delegate Jennifer Foy from Prince William, is trying to get the ERA passed in Virginia.
Yes.
That would give equal rights in the Constitution to women.
Yes.
At least state it. So... where is that going to happen, and what difference does it make this far, the time to do it passed back in the 80s?
I certainly hope so, but the 2 points.
Symbolic.
Well, it's actually more than symbolic, because if you look at the U.S. Constitution and all of its amendments, the words equal rights for gender is not in there. We just assume it is because of the 14th Amendment.
Is it going to pass?
I hope so, and I certainly will believe that they will. What's key is that, unlike in previous years, we have a Republican who's in a vulnerable district, a senator who's taking the lead on the Senate side, and Jennifer Carroll Foy, who's an outstanding freshman member. She's taken it on the House
side.
She's
a former prosecutor.
Yeah, and I've co-sponsored that.
We want to go to Iman on the line from Chantilly, Virginia.
Thanks for taking my call, and I want to ask the guest, I've been to Crystal City about a week ago, and I could not find a parking lot. I mean, I remember 20 years ago, the places that used to be a private parking now is a high-rise building, and the average condos is $500,000. Now, yes. You tell me that I live in Herndon, and my taxes are going up just because Amazon's coming in. Amazon, it might create piece of the jobs, but it's not going to create anything else but headache for us. It really, and I tell you one thing, look at the affordable apartments in Arlington. They're taking over and destroying and get rid of all the poor people out of the place so they can build high-rise buildings. It is a disgrace. And this man is talking about creating jobs. You may get paid well, but don't assume everybody gets paid well.
So. All right. Thank you, Iman.
That's a real worry in urban areas. They're becoming too expensive for middle-class people.
Absolutely. Now, like I just said, I am very concerned about both the housing cost, the transportation cost, as well as the idea that we're picking and choosing only those places that already have plenty of opportunities to build more opportunities. I really wished if there was a way to spread this jobs down to Southwest, Southside, where we really need extra jobs in Virginia.
Real estate agents, I've been told already, are that the prices are already starting to go up in Crystal City where the apartments are there. I'm not sure their condos are $500,000 on average, but there are substantial expensive condos.
There's no question it's extremely expensive.
Okay. Well, I want to go yet to another subject. Do we have time to talk to him about sports gambling? Casinos. Virginia has been a holdout in this region. Pennsylvania, West Virginia, D.C. I mean, D.C. doesn't have a casino. Maryland. All have casinos. Your legislature this coming session may well approve casinos.
Yes.
Down in Bristol, way down on 81, they want a casino there. There's an Indian tribe. It's federal approval maybe to have a casino. You're going to have to deal with sports gambling on the internet, which we'll talk.
Yeah, so we've already seen a couple of bills pre-filed by my state senator, Chad Peterson, and others, and you'll see a lot of conversations about this. Let me set the stage on this because I think Virginia, as a traditionally conservative, culturally conservative state, we like to say in politics that there's, you know, some wedge issues and everybody's heard of the God, guns, and gays. Well, there are five G's in Virginia: God, guns, gays, gynecology, and gambling. Those are the five that were always considered to be the toxic wedge issues that we just never wanted to get involved in. Well, it looks like we're going to be dealing with gambling this year. And I think the way it's going to come up is based on the Supreme Court decision, as you know, the Murphy case from a few months ago, which struck down the federal law that had banned sports gambling. We are now looking to see if we can add sports gambling. But as the conversation—
Are you for it?
Oh, yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine with it. So the conversation about sports gambling, as we start expanding that, then naturally goes to what about the other casinos, the gaming and what have you. I think what's going to happen is that there are at least a couple of bills that'll be localized, one in the Hampton Roads area, maybe Portsmouth, another one in the Bristol area, where they will allow for the local governments to then decide if they want to have it as a local referendum. My concern, of course, is that, I mean, it's great that they're looking for economic development, but my concern is that we have the biggest competition here in Northern Virginia. Just across the river from Alexandria, you have MGM, you have
Wilson Bridge.
Yeah, you have Maryland Live. Tons and tons of our constituents in our Northern Virginia residents are spending all their money just across the river. So if there's any way that we can have something in Northern Virginia as well to compete with that, in addition to the other three regions that they're talking about, I would be for that to make sure that it's a statewide application, not just regional application.
Virginia's essentially been dragging its feet on this issue, and you could have missed the big boom on it.
Yes.
And I guess with one question I have is, how do you make sure that the college sports, which is huge in Virginia, I mean, the Virginia Tech game,
be no sports, not betting.
This will not,
it'll exclude college.
Okay.
Yeah.
Be pro sports.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that is.
Which, who can say that college football isn't pro?
Yeah, we took a step last year with horses, horse racing.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Tom.
So, Tom, the one question I have for you, from news this week in D.C., the new nightlife office director, people are referring to this position as the nighttime mayor or the nightlife mayor.
Everyone is except the mayor of the city.
As someone who enjoys the nightlife in D.C., what is this person going
to
do?
Well, first of all, I'm too old to enjoy the nightlife in D.C., so I don't. But this is the nightlife industry, that restaurants and bars are a huge part of the city's economy. And this is an effort by the council and the mayor to have a representative at night for businesses that from 5 o'clock in the afternoon to 2 or 3 in the morning. And so she appointed Sean Townsend, who's a former Alcohol Beverage Control Board investigator, to be the representative for her at night. But he's not the nightmare. I am the nightmare. She's the mayor of the entire city. But he doesn't have a lot of power, and it's very odd. When they announced him, they didn't make him available to the media, so he hasn't even been interviewed by reporters.
Maybe he only works at night. He's like,
well, maybe he'll have to work at night. But this is for someone who can go out and listen to the bars, the people. Jack Evans has
arrived. Speaking of the nightlife, Mayor.
anyway, so he's going to. He doesn't have a lot of power, but he's supposed to talk to the bars, talk to the licensing agencies, talk to the communities about, and to make sure that this big industry at night has some coordination in the city, because it's only getting bigger.
And obviously, this is an issue that our guests,
like noisy people in the room, like,
where's Kojo?
Is this live?
He heard you were going to be here, Mr. Evans, and he refused to come in.
Ward 2 Councilmember Jack Evans joining us on the Politics Hour. Councilmember, great to have you here.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be here.
So one of the other topics we were going to discuss right now was the Mambo sauce controversy.
I love Mambo sauce.
So we're going to throw it to Councilmember Evans. Are you annoyed by Mambo sauce?
Well,
Mambo
sauce? Make sure. I know that Kojo had a show on this tomorrow, yesterday, but you know, this is a sauce that many people identify with the district. The mayor put on her Facebook page, questioned whether that was I've forgotten exactly what she said, but she seemed to call into question Mambo sauce. So where are you on the Mambo sauce?
I love Mambo sauce. It's a district, almost district-centric sauce, although it wasn't really invented here. And so I'm a big fan. I actually use it. It tastes a little like sweetness, you know, like that stuff you put on Chinese food.
Spicy and sweet.
What did you think of the mayor putting herself out there in this conversation?
I can't speak for the mayor.
On this issue?
Yes, on
or
this
on
issue.
Any, can you speak for the mayor on any issue?
I'm sure she probably regrets having made that comment or tweet or whatever.
I have been unable to determine, because I haven't heard her say anything follow-up about it.
Yes.
Is that she, I think the Post or somebody, the deceased or someone did a story that said, found some previous thing where she had praised.
She wrote a letter, I think, to the owner of a Mambo sauce company.
I don't know why she did this. I mean, I haven't heard why did she.
Maybe she had a bad.
I've never spoken to her about it.
Bad.
And actually probably won't.
So Councilmember Evans, let's jump into some interesting news that's really popping up this week regarding sports betting. I understand you had a hearing yesterday about
we voted it out of my committee.
About this bill.
What was the vote?
The vote was
did anybody oppose
four in favor, and I think Alyssa voted present.
Okay, so just give us sort of the broad strokes of what's happening here, because I think there's a lot of I tried reading up on this. It's very confusing. What's going to happen?
Okay, 30-second summary on this.
You can take a little bit more time.
32 seconds.
All right, in May of this year, the Supreme Court ruled for the first time that sports betting was legal everywhere in America. Prior to that time, there was a federal law back in 1932 that only limited sports betting to Nevada, state of Nevada. New Jersey sued the federal government and won. And so the Supreme Court ruled sports betting can take place anywhere in America, but it's up to the states to pass a law to allow it in their particular jurisdiction. Immediately, 5 states did it. New Jersey, of course, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Rhode Island, and Mississippi. They're all casino states where MGM and other casinos are very active. And so they were ready for this. I immediately moved forward too. I believe sports betting, whether you support betting or not, or gambling or not, is going to be huge. I think the district lost out when the MGM casino was built less than a quarter of a mile from my border, and have a mailing and attendance list of over 150,000 people from the district who have gone there.
Just going to the garage. I had to go there for a couple of events, and the garage is filled with D.C. license tags.
Okay, so we lose all that. So I don't want to lose out on sports betting. We are in session all year round, as you know. Maryland and Virginia are not. So I moved very quickly to introduce a bill after consultation with the mayor and the chair and some of my colleagues in September when we came back from recess. We held a hearing on it, and we moved the first draft, the first bill, out of my committee on Tuesday. It will go to the full council this coming Tuesday, December 4th, for a first vote. If we're successful, second vote December 18th on the mayor's desk. To Congress starting early January, 60-day layover. And if everything goes according to plan, we could have sports betting in the District of Columbia by opening day.
And just can you just like, I'm trying to imagine what this will look like.
Sure.
I understand if you can go to Las Vegas, you go up to the sports book and you can bet on a game or whatever. Here in D.C., we wouldn't have that, right? This would be more of a like a on your phone type
thing? No, you'd have both.
Okay.
So in the bill, it identifies five venues where, at a minimum, the five sports venues where this would take place, like you're talking about in Las Vegas. And that would be Nats Park, Capital One Arena, formerly Verizon Center, Audi Field for the soccer, I call it the Wizards Practice Facility.
The Sports Arena.
Yeah, and then RFK Stadium, because we anticipate that someday there will be a football stadium there and it will be allow sports gaming. It can also take place elsewhere. Convention center, of course, but it can take place in small bars, restaurants, and hotels. Cafe Milano, my favorite place, could have sports
what
betting.
What would you bet on at Cafe Milano?
No, bet on sports.
To be clear, it's only pro sports, not college sports.
No, it's college sports. It's any sports.
It is college sports.
Yes, it is. Oh. It's every sport. All sports are eligible. So, All right, how does
Best
this work?
News.
You can, and to make it more complicated, there is one issue about who will have an app on their phone or et cetera to bet. In the arenas themselves, the teams have the ability to partner with someone, and I know the Nationals have partnered with MGM, who is a good company, one of the biggest in the world. And then if you go into Nats Park, you go on the MGM app, and you can bet either at their kiosks, and they will have a big gambling place, or on your phone, whether Bryce Harper's going to swing at the next pitch or not, or bet on anything you want. If you are in the streets of Washington under the bill today, which may change, you have to use the DC Lottery app. But again, or sitting on your couch, you can go on that app, and you can bet on any sporting event in the country. So, and then if bars and restaurants, et cetera, want to participate, for a smaller fee than the large arenas, they can get kiosks like lottery machines, similar, in their bars and restaurants, and you can either play on the machine and or use your iPhone.
Now, the city paper disclosed this one pager that was being passed around the Wilson Building. This for all the Major League Baseball, Basketball Association, PGA Tour, Monumental Sports, MGM, DraftKings, all this said that you guys need to open this up more. Not let it be run by the
lottery. Let me address the three.
But to have licensed, 10 or so licenses around town. And also, they want a piece of the action.
Sure. All right, so there's three issues.
They want 25 cents for every $100 waged.
There's three issues that I had to consider and made decisions on. The first you mentioned, I'll do them in reverse order, is something called a royalty fee, or they call it an integrity fee. None of the other five jurisdictions that have gambling have done that. What it would be is 0.25% of the gross take of all the money bet would go to the leagues. Their argument is we are providing the data. We are, frankly, providing the sports. We're providing everything. We should get something out of this. No other jurisdiction has done it. In attempting to throw him a bone, put in an integrity fee or royalty fee, but not at that level. I said you can have 0.25% of the profits after the payouts. And keep in mind, if a dollar is bet, 95 cents goes back to the people who bet. So there's only a 5-cent profit. Under the district one, 80 cents goes back to the people, and there's a 20 cent. But regardless how you look at it, I put the percentage on the smaller amount. Even with that, Councilmember Gray moved to take it out, and my colleague supported him, and it's gone. And I do not believe I can get a royalty fee back. Second issue was exclusivity around the particular venues. Nats Park, Verizon Center, et cetera, are saying we're going to put millions and millions of dollars into our place to have sports betting, and we don't think it's fair that Legal Seafood directly across the street, who will do absolutely nothing, can compete against us. So we want a five-block radius of non-competition. I said, about five blocks is a lot. Let's go with two. So that's where we are now. Robert White on the committee had an objection to that, but it did stay in.
Did he want more blocks or fewer?
No, fewer blocks. Yeah, he wanted, because there there will be entities within those two blocks right. who won't be able to compete,
just,
but that's the answer.
It just seems like the wild, wild west here, and
no,
we're kind
of
making stuff up on the fly, it sounds
Well, we
like.
Are doing that, and it's not, don't say making it up on the fly, because it's never been done anywhere else in the country before. So that's why I'm inventing it, you're right, as I go along.
It's happening in real time.
It's happening in real time. And the third issue is, let me go real quick, is the one Tom raised. And this is the most important issue. Who gets to use what app where? And again, it's our CFO's position that the district will make the most money that if, other than the major sports venues, you have to use the lottery, the DC lottery app, because
right.
we will make 20 cents on the dollar. If we use their app, we get 10%. 10% of 5 cents, which is, you know, I don't know what it is.
The CFO has made this statement.
No, he has the numbers to prove it. Now, the one catch in that whole thing, and this is where it could all fall apart, is in our model that is in the bill today, we return 80 cents on the dollar. You bet a dollar, you win, we'll give you 80 cents back. In the MGM model, you bet a dollar, you get 95 cents back. Or, more importantly, in the underground economy of sports betting, which is $150 billion
right.
with your bookie, you get 95 cents back.
So, that,
so will
that
you
20,
use our app?
And it sounds like the answer would be no, right? I mean, that 20%.
It's hard to say. Like you, me, Tom, we might just bet on the app, and we don't care that much about the 80 cents versus 95. But I got to tell you, people who are in this business do. And there is a movement on the council among some of my colleagues to go with the multiple apps, meaning
right.
MGM, DraftKings, et cetera, will be anywhere they are in the city, and we can use that app. And it's not a bad model. I'm not even against
right.
that.
But we've seen in the past here in D.C. how these lottery things always end up causing issues, from the slot machines to the whole matter a couple of years ago with
Michael
the intro. Right, Michael
Brown took yeah. bribes because
I mean,
he was trying to bring internet gambling to town.
This is a thorny issue, right?
Gambling, from the time it started, probably
right.
in biblical times, has always been a problem. There is no doubt there is organized crime is involved in gambling. You
right.
know, people are always coming up with scams to beat the system. I could even
right.
tell you, if there is a machine in a bar and you
right.
walk in and say, I want to bet $100, and the bartender says, I'll cover that instead.
Right.
Bet with me. Now, the downside is, if the bartender takes a bunch of bets on his or her own and loses, then what happens when he or she can't pay?
But you're basically saying the DC is going to be the bookie here, right? And we're going to be able to do it? I mean,
we would contract with someone
else. The DC lottery, which, I mean, you think they're equipped to handle this complicated mobile betting scenario you're describing?
It would be
right
Interlot has the lottery.
Correct.
Interlot has
right.
the license to do the DC lottery.
Interlot
so
has the
Interlot
license, correct.
Would they expand their project there,
yes.
or would that be subject to bidding? And
well, it would be subject to bidding, but for the sake of argument, Interlot right now, which is one of the largest gaming companies in the world, they control almost the entire European market, so they're not foreign to this by any means, would be the company, at the moment, at least if we started tomorrow, that would do exactly what you're talking about. Interlock would be the MGM
right.
of the thing. So it's not the district lottery setting this up. Of course, that would be ridiculous. It would be the district lottery contracting with Interlock to set it up and go with it. So it really comes down to the argument being, should we, the district government, have our own app that gets used because we may make more money, or should we let everyone come in? In other jurisdictions, there's no right or wrong answer, because other jurisdictions are running these things out of casinos, and we don't have a casino.
Would
so
you want a casino?
I don't know, Tom. That's such a volatile issue. Every time you bring that up, people get crazy about it. I think we lost out when the MGM built their casino, and all that's gone. So I think it's a fallacy, and I don't gamble, and I don't think gambling's good. But
you're willing to.
But it's going to happen, and we don't want to lose the revenue that is going
to
be.
How much money do you think
this.
The city could make take in terms
I
of
think
revenue,
initially,
roughly speaking?
Initially, it will be in the $50-$70 million range. But if sports gambling is unlike any other gambling, like roulette and craps and stuff, I don't really understand that stuff. I don't want to play it. I'm afraid I'll lose my money. But, you know, I'm an expert on sports. You know, you and me. You want the Lions, you want the Cubs. You know, people feel that way, though, seriously.
Right.
You know, and is Harper going to swing at the next pitch? Well, you know, I could bet on it. I think, as I told you, there's $150 billion.
This is a problem gambling.
No question
right.
about it. But that'll happen anyway.
Would there be protections for people
yes.
to have emergency
yes.
phone numbers?
Yes, we're putting money in
no
to
ATMs
set that up.
Next to
and Council Member Evans, I mean, part of this conversation, there was concern raised about this consulting firm that you've started, the NSC, And I guess it was the registered agent was the lobbyist, Bill Jarvis. I mean, can you address that?
Sure.
I mean, talk about sort of what is the firewall here to make sure that there aren't the companies that you're consulting with aren't have nothing to do with what we're talking about
today. The article
today.
You're reading from that was written by Jeffrey Anderson is just plain false. And he knows that. I have never had a business relationship with Bill Jarvis, never have, and never will. Bill is a lawyer that when I set up my company, has done a number of them, so he helped me set it up, and he's put himself as the registered agent, which we have now changed to be me. There's no one else involved in my company but me, and the person who wrote that article, Anderson, absolutely knows that. And without that piece of information in his article makes absolutely no sense.
But I guess the consulting firm part, I mean, are the companies...
It's a legal firm.
A legal firm. But
yes.
are you consulting or doing legal work for any firms that are involved in this
no,
issue?
No, absolutely not.
And so how do we know which firms you're working with, I guess would be the question.
Yeah. Who are your clients?
Exactly. Well,
yeah, and that's a good question for that any law firm gives the same answer I will. Our clients are proprietary information. So you just have to rely on me.
You have an obligation to report clients by law.
Yeah.
If you have any clients that have anything to do with your official business, you have to disclose those in your business.
Exactly.
And you have not disclosed any.
So I don't have any.
So.
And if you say, well, you're lying, well, okay, then you can say I'm lying. But it's not true. I have none. And never will. And my, you know, again, this sounds a little self-serving, but my reputation is everything. I've been on this council 28 years. Do you think I'm going to risk some idiotic relationship for what? You know, so I'm just telling you. And when I was with a law firm, which I've been the entire time I've been on the council, it's the same issue. Who are the clients of the law firm? And the clients of the law firm are proprietary information.
I guess the difference, though, this time would be if you're working at Patton Boggs, you've got lot of clients. Now it's just you, so there's much more of a direct sort of connection between
that.
The list of clients you might have.
Yeah, and I understand that. So, which is one reason I may close this down and go back to Patton Boggs, because I thought this would be much easier, but apparently it has raised so many questions.
And you had to only report how much money you've made from that law firm, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Have you reported any money? Have you made any money?
Yeah, I've made a little bit of money.
Three kids in college.
Have they
all graduated yet?
No, they're all seniors this year. Yeah. They will be finishing up in May, and the last advice I gave all three of them at Thanksgiving was they must have a job that pays money come September because the gravy train is over.
Just very briefly go back to what Patrick was saying. The reason some people are nervous about this is not because of any one story that's been written by one journalist. Is Michael Brown tried to bring internet lobbying gambling to the city. He took money and went to prison. He's out now. And so as you suggested, this organized crime, people just want to be certain that either you or the other 12 members of the council or the mayor and her associates are not looking to profit on gambling.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
You can say, as far as you know in your business, yes, that's true.
That's absolutely true. Okay. And again, in Michael's case, if my memory serves me correct, the entity wanted Michael to pass specific legislation that benefited them, and he attempted to do that. Now, in that context, you recuse yourself. If a client of mine were involved in something I'm voting on, and I've done that two or three times in the past, as have Bill Lightfoot, John Ray, Kevin Chavis, Harold Brazil, and all the other individuals who were. Mary Che just did it that last week on GW University.
Your colleague, Council Chair Phil Mendelson, who led the effort to repeal Initiative 77, is opposed to revisiting the issue, saying, quote, based on the reaction I've gotten since the council voted, I think most citizens of the district are ready to move on. What is going to happen here with I-77?
As far as I know,
that's
it's dead.
That's the
you can tell them it's the tipping.
Yes.
It involves tipping, paying minimum wage to waiters, and et cetera. And, you know, again, I represent half the restaurants in the city, or used to anyway. It's pretty close now. And there wasn't a place I went that I was not surrounded by the owner and the employees saying, please don't let this happen. So it did not. We overturned it, as we had four laws in the past, and I believe it's dead. The only way it could come back, as I see it, is if the promoters of it try to put it back on the ballot again.
And there's an effort to put together a reference.
And this time, we will pay attention. Number one, it will not be in a primary election, but rather a general election, and the language will be specific as to what they're asking for. And in that case, it will probably get voted down.
And you're prepared for the blowback, though, from voters who say, hey, I voted for this, and it passed, and now you are basically voiding it.
Yes, and because the Council of the District of Columbia is the ultimate determination of what the laws are in this city, always have, always will be, and so if the citizens pass it, if we pass it, however it becomes law, we change our, we have a different decision, it is our obligation to move forward and act on it.
Except if Congress steps in, and then they're the ultimate. Yeah.
Well, then we complain, so we're hypocrites in that regard.
This is such an emotional issue for a lot of people. Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist, Washington Post journalist, who was slaughtered by the Saudis. There was a move by you and two others to have the roadway in front of the Saudi embassy here named Jamal Khashoggi Way.
Correct.
But the law is that the person has to be dead 2 years for that to happen. There have been some exceptions, Frank Kameny, former council member Jerry Moore. You ran into a roadblock. The chairman of the council, Phil Mendelson, said, well, I don't want to violate the law that says we have to wait 2 years. Is that issue now dead?
I believe so, and I don't want to throw Phil under the bus. That's not really fair to him. But I asked Phil yesterday, what do you think? I mean, I would like to move it. I would like to name it. I know what the law is, and I know you have to wait 2 years. And he said, you know, unfortunately, he is a stickler, as he is and should be, for what the law is, and doesn't think it's a good idea to grant.
But there's a phrase, notwithstanding.
No, I understand. But then, where do you draw the line once you make an exception? And then,
You've made two exceptions.
Or a while back, if I remember correctly. But you're right. I was on the council when we did it, so it's up to me. I might.
If I were an activist, I'd just go and make my own signs and put.
Well,
them
I was going to say that.
That's what I would do. But I'm a journalist, so I can't do it.
Let's go to Dave in Washington. Has a question about the TIF.
Sure.
In Anacostia. Dave, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
TIF.
I was interested in the tax increment financing for Union Square. I read yesterday that Councilmember White in Ward 8 that he put it on hold and that it was going to go to Jack Evans. I wasn't sure about that process and what the next steps were.
Yes, Councilmember Trayon White asked me if I would put it on hold, remove it from the agenda that it was on last Tuesday, and in deference to my colleague from Ward 8, I did.
Can you just say one sentence,
like, what is it? What is the
TIF?
What is the tax increment financing?
There's a vacant lot in Ward 8 by the big chair, if you know where that is, and a developer would like to build a mixed-use, high-density project there. It would include a hotel, housing, both affordable and not affordable, restaurant, and office. So it's a unique development in that part of town. A TIF is tax increment financing, is giving a loan to a developer to build something that otherwise would not get done. And the developer argues, and probably rightly so, that building a hotel and some of this retail in Ward 8 does not make economic sense, but if the city participates, it does. So that's why we were ready
and
to move forward.
It sounds like perhaps Councilmember Trent White maybe wants more concessions from this developer.
Correct, and he believes that there should be more affordable housing in the project, and affordable for the people who actually live there, not just affordable, and more jobs for people who live in the neighborhood.
So where were that? Where it's on hold indefinitely
it's on hold.
Now?
Yes, and so it's not dead. If Councilmember White is successful with negotiating with the developer to get something that he's satisfied with, and he comes back to me. Now, we have run out of time, unfortunately,
for
this session.
We're about to run out of time right here.
But we could reintroduce it in January.
Let's take another caller. We have Aaron from Washington, D.C., who wants to ask about the fare evasion issue, which is something
Good question.
So, Aaron, go ahead.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to make two comments and hear your responses about this issue. The first is, I have yet to hear a really good response to the comparison that, you know, evading fare evasion on Metro should be a ticket because, not paying a meter or getting a parking ticket is, you know, you don't get arrested for that. The second issue I have is that Metro would be more convincing to me that it wants to address fare evasion if it didn't make it so easy to do so in the first place. As far as I'm aware, most Metro stations have a service door that's not secured. You can just walk right through it, and then many people, and the turnstiles are just very easy to jump over.
So
thank you.
Aaron, thank you. So, Councilmember Evans, you're both on the council, and you're also
chairman of the board of Metro.
Fare evasion also are the people who just simply walk on the bus and refuse to pay and dare the bus driver to.
Let me address Tom's thing real quick. We lose $25 million a year, and that's a solid number of people who do not pay their bus fares. How do we know that? When a person gets on our bus and they don't pay the fare, the driver taps a button underneath his console. We have instructed our bus drivers not to get in arguments, fights with passengers for obvious reasons. So we lose $25 million there. It is likely we lose more than that because two-thirds of our riders are on the train system.
The rail.
On the rail system to that. Now, let me address them both quickly. On the we make it easy for fare evaders. The door opens and closes because of people who have handicaps. We are now going to lock those doors. And we're getting a lot of pushback from
these are the gates next to the station managers.
Yes, and so we're going to lock them and make it a little bit harder. I am unwilling, as the chairman of the Board of Metro, and maybe somebody else in this job someday will change their mind, to make this thing look like a prison, like New York. I could put in turnstiles like that. You can't get through. They're ceiling to floor, and they twist. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, the metal grates.
I'm not willing to do that. I want to find a different way of dealing with fare evasion. The problem we are having with the decriminalization that Councilmember Allen has put out there is, first of all, the data is all faulty. But secondly, if we issue, and let me, because he mentioned the parking ticket. If I don't pay my parking tickets, there is a remedy. I can't register my car, and I have to pay them.
You can be booted.
And I can be booted. Thank you, Tom. It's not a criminal offense, but I will be booted. I can't register my car. If I get a speeding ticket and don't pay it, I can't get my driver's license. So if we go to a civil penalty in Metro and we hand you a civil ticket and you tear it up and throw it in the trash, I have no remedy to enforce that.
Right.
If you get a criminal citation, there is a remedy that has never been used. And as people have now tried to determine, we cannot find one person who has ever gotten a criminal record for evading a fare in Metro.
And that is the final word from Councilmember Jack Evans.
Oh, no.
Tom, again, thank you as always for joining us this hour on the Politics Hour.
I've got more questions.
I'm Patrick Madden.
Yeah, I can stay another hour.
Filling in for Kojo Namdi. He will
Why do I have to go now?
Back next week. Today's Politics Hour was produced by Mark Gunner. Coming up Monday, before the end of her first semester, a freshman died of the adenovirus at the University of Maryland. And over the Thanksgiving weekend, more cases were discovered, upping the school's total to 9. What's going on? Plus, public restrooms are the norm in many major cities, but not in D.C. A group is trying to change that, and we'll explore their plan. That all starts Monday at noon. I'm Patrick Madden, sitting in for Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, Margaret Barthel, and Lauren Marco. Our managing producer is Ingelisa Schrobstorf. Our intern is Talia Drayton. Our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, go to kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.